Welcome to Coaching Uncaged by Animas, the podcast that explores the art, science, and career of coaching. And now, introducing your host and interviewer, Yannick Jacob.
Well, Lawrence Barrett, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you.
Hi, Yannick. Great to be here.
I've been looking forward to this, not only because I saw a recent lecture of yours to students of mine at Cambridge, which was wonderful. You just synthesized a lot of Jung's thinking and different perspectives on it into an hour, which is an incredibly complex task. So I'm really excited to lay out the landscape of where you're coaching from. And as the audience probably knows by now, this season we really look into the underlying perspectives and fundamental assumptions about different coaching approaches. And I mean, you literally wrote the book on Jungian coaching. You've been in systems psychodynamics for deep work for like ever. Decades of practice in organizations with your clients. You write really well. So I'm really excited. I wonder if there's anything you would add so people kind of understand more about where you're speaking about this from.
What's a good place to start? I think one of the problems that I see with a lot of system psychodynamic work, so whether it's the kind of psychoanalytic work or a more Jungian frame, is that there is, in some ways, a kind of unnecessary complication. A lot of the theory can be, it can be very deep and it can be very complex and very esoteric. And, you know, there's a lot of debates about how many angels fit on the head of a pin and all of this sort of good stuff. And I think that's great if you really want to deep dive into it. But from a practitioner point of view, particularly Jungian thinking, but I think also sort of more psychoanalytic ideas, they're actually really practical and really quite easy when you look at them at one level. And so I'm always disappointed in a way with a lot of what I read about this, that it is so complex, because I think it puts off a lot of coaches. I think there's a sort of fear of the dark and this sort of reification of the deep, and it's terribly, terribly worthy and important and difficult and high risk. And actually, 90% of it isn't. It's pretty easy. It expresses the lived experience that we have. And so in some ways, for me, it's not that difficult to talk about things like this over the course of an hour, but I think it shouldn't be difficult for anyone, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. I wish it was like that, but I think that's true. A lot of coaches who like, they hear psychoanalysis and they hear psychoanalytic perspectives. They think about Freud, maybe they think about Jung, and they think this is incredibly deep stuff. You have to study the unconscious for like decades. And then there's all this language that you can't just read many of these books. You need to like really work through them. I come from an existential perspective. There's so many texts that are just so convoluted and dense that they're just inaccessible to so many people. And I think especially in the coaching field, that's a shame, because I think there's so much knowledge in this that is actually quite graspable once you kind of translate it.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the complexity has its place. You know, don't get me wrong. I think it's really important to sort of go deeper, dig deeper, understand more. But at an entry level, things can be much simpler, I think, than practitioner academics often allow them to be.
Great. So let's dig into that. I'm excited. Maybe let's start with kind of laying out the landscape a little bit. You specialize in Jung, obviously Jung and Freud were, Jung was Freud's student. At some point they parted ways. There's lots of different perspectives, within Freudian psychology as well. I mean, Freud's ideas have developed into psychodynamics, became kind of quite operationalized in some ways. A lot has been lost, I think, in translation as well. My wife, as some of our listeners will know, is a Lacanian psychoanalyst. So she kind of rekindled a lot of love for Freudian ideas. But it's quite fragmented. And I heard you mention as well, within the field of Jungian psychology, it's also quite fragmented. There's many different perspectives on it. So could you talk a little bit about where you place Jungian approach to coaching or Jungian psychology within maybe the wider field of psychology? Maybe talk a little bit about how Jungian, it's not one thing. There's many perspectives on it. So yeah, it would be great if you could lay that out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's often a lot of, I think a misunderstanding about actually what happened around the time of the founding of this, because I would suggest that Jung wasn't Freud's student.
All right.
There was a coming together. I think many Freudians would like that to be the perspective, but I don't think that's entirely true. There was a coming together for a brief period of time, which was, I think, very fruitful for both men and for others in their circle, and a split on some fundamental ideas. And that split seems to have sort of echoed, if you like, through depth psychology ever since. I mean, we have this sort of strange, almost compulsive need to insist that this particular theory or that particular theory is the theory. And I think what people have to remember, I mean, Freud himself talked about this with this idea of metapsychology, that we're using two-dimensional models to describe, in essence, a four-dimensional framework. Mind is still almost entirely theory, even if people want to pretend otherwise. That's a fantasy. We can't cut an ego out and put it on the table and go, this is an ego, that's what it does. We don't know. It is phenomenological, so we observe. We also have to remember that the instrument through which we view, measure, evidence, research mind is mind. So the bias of the researcher, the bias of the practitioner is always playing out in the way they see the world, because that's how it is. I think if we were better able to recognize that, we would be able to return, I think, to the idea that mind in a way was more philosophical than scientific. I'm not sure I like the idea of psychology desperately trying to prove itself as a science in the same way as physics, because it's not a science in the same way as physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a subjectivity and an intersubjectivity to it. So I think that's important as a backdrop. Now when I look at Jung, and I think to extent Freud, but certainly Jung was a phenomenologist. So he looked at the world. He was a really good observer of the things human beings do.
And what the experience, right? I mean, phenomenology is a study of experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a study of stuff that we do through time, not just in a consulting room or in a particular context or with psychopathologies. We produce art. We produce science. We go to war. We have religion. All of these things are the phenomenology, or the evidence, if you like, of humankind. And what Jung was really able to do was to create a way of thinking about this that he, by the way, stressed was a moment in time, a hypothesis. I mean, Jung was very clear that if someone came up with a better view, they should go with a better view. He wasn't suggesting that this was the final.
Yeah. So there's idea. A scientific mindset, but without the ability to get the kind of data that cognitive behavioral psychologists would have access to.
Absolutely. And also, even with that, I would say a lot of the data that I see on things like cognitive behavioral psychology, coming from a depth psychology point of view, you tend to wonder about the psychology of the researcher. And then you can start to dig into the research methodology. You know, well, isn't it interesting you chose that and not that? You know, there was a fabulous study on love and intimacy. I don't know if you remember this one, but it's kind of apocryphal, that was done back in the 70s. And all of the research studies were students. And sense of students, love and intimacy, I don't know if your experience is anything to go by compared to mine, it's very, very different to love and intimacy across the population, across culture at different times and at different times of life. So we tend to operate under this kind of needed fantasy that there is an answer to human psyche. And I think that's problematic for lots of reasons. And what Jung was able to do was give us a lens to say, this is what I observe. Mm-hmm. Let's see how the mind works in the context of this. Not what the mind is as a series of two-dimensional structures, but how the mind actually functions through time. Mm-hmm. And we'll work with that. And if that comes up with results that are practical and useful and clinically valuable, and for coaches, you know, valuable in terms of the sort of outcomes we need with our clients, good, it works. Yeah. It's a very pragmatic mindset. Yeah. So I like that a lot. And I think certainly in Jungian psychology, that's broadly been adhered to, but we still have this strange tendency to split and to break into little clumps and to, there's a kind of elitism linked to it. Which, coming back to the point about summary, I think is slightly uncomfortable for me, because again, a lot of the language that people use in describing this stuff, to my mind, is a defense of identity based on this need for elitism and academic superiority, which in fact is, it doesn't really hold water when you start to examine it in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, and I think psychoanalysis often has this air around it that they somehow know better, or, you know, this person has got it right, or that person has got it right. And then within psychoanalysis, there's these camps who claim that they have understood this better than others, or able to interpret things better. So, I mean, Freud, widely recognized as the founder of psychoanalysis in an age where psychology was focused very much on behavior, observing behavior, the idea of the unconscious, Freud and Jung have that very much in common. So could you draw out a little bit of where that split came from? Because famously, Jung and Freud went separate ways. They agree on a lot, I think, but they disagreed on some fundamental ideas. Could you draw some of these ideas out so that coaches out there can get a bit of an understanding of what makes these ideas so valuable, and what Jung brought into this that really took a different path?
Yeah, and I think that split, interestingly, I mean, I'm not familiar with all the nuances of it. I'm not a sort of historian of Jung and Freud, but the split has enormous implications for coaching work. And one of the key questions that I think is important is the role of the unconscious itself. Mm-hmm. Because a Freudian model, as far as I'm understanding it, and I'm being slightly black and white on this, so some Freudians may slightly disagree with me, but broadly the Freudian model is things happen to you, it falls into the unconscious where it is repressed, and that drives your behavior. Mm-hmm. And if you want to become healthier, happier, live a fuller life, you need to revisit the past, dig it up again, relook at it, and resolve it, and life will improve for you. That's the kind of basic model of Freudian analysis. So the past is, in essence, a kind of dead, fixed repository of real memories.
Hence the now, stereotypical tell me about your father, or the exactly. Mother complex, like birth yeah. trauma, penis envy, yeah. you know, all of these stereotypes. They go back to the psyche forming in very early days. And revisiting this will help us. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's true to a point, but it's not the whole of the picture. If you take a Jungian view, Jung disagreed with that for several reasons. One, we are living in a mind, we're living in psyche that is constantly changing and evolving. It is dynamic. So one, we are not reliant entirely upon our personal experiences. We don't exist alone in the universe. We are part of a family system. We're part of what we might think of as a tribal system, you know, the groups we are part of. We're part of a culture. We're part of a collective unconscious. We have a somatic inheritance, what in Jungian world we call the psychoid. And all of these things are shaping and changing what we are at a point in time. And it's very dynamic. So the depth of that, so let's say the psychoid unconscious, which I'm writing about at the moment, is our lived somatic experience of the world. It's where soma and psyche come together. That's deep, but it's not deep in a sort of dead and distant way. It's deep in the sense that it is intense. We literally do live in the world. We literally do experience a physical body, which shapes how we are and shapes all the people around us and shapes probably the animals that we interact with, possibly even more than that. So there is a very definite lived interaction, and the psyche is a moving and four-dimensional sense, the structure in that sense. It is constantly changing. It is constantly dynamic. That, interestingly, I think matches a lot of research into things like memory, Susan Loftus's work, where I think she's very clear that memory is an angle, a perspective on an event, but it isn't the event. Everybody has different memories of events, and your memories will change as you move through life. So from a Jungian point of view, the question is not, let's go back, dig up the psyche, and that will The question is, what are we remembering? And why are we remembering it in that way? And what purpose does it serve? Which leads to what we call in the Jungian world the teleology of the psyche. So Jung's view was that instead of this kind of dead unconscious that is repressed and holds things, he saw the unconscious more as a parallel intelligence, a source of intuition and impulse, a perspective, a bit like McGilchrist's right brain, I think. A sense of the world that is holistic and systemic and has its own agenda. So the ego, which is uncomfortable with the unconscious most of the time, will tend to repress it, sure. But if we're able to listen to the unconscious, if we're able to build a connection with our dreams, our fantasies, our impulses, then we can start to think of it not in terms of what has happened to us in the past, but in terms of why we are thinking about that in the present. Because for Jung, and this is a second key principle, is this idea of the compensatory nature of psyche. So what Jung basically suggests is the mind seeks wholeness. And part of that wholeness is linked to the understanding of the unconscious and the conscious mind, and bringing the two together to become more integrated, more able to work through these kind of impulses and emotions.
What does wholeness mean in Jungian context?
We would talk about wholeness as the self, and the self is the potentiality that we have, this ability to become bigger, to become more, to move towards our potential, the fullness of what is possible. A journey we'll never get, you know, because ultimately that effectively means we become God, and that's clearly going to be a bit of a problem. but the idea that we can become more, that we can grow, right, that we can develop.
And that oozes coaching.
Well, it does. I think it does, exactly. Because what, in essence, you're trying to do is to help people integrate all of the different perspectives that they have on the world. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply about how I can solve a particular problem in a rational, egoic way. It's also about me and say, well, what are my impulses? What do I feel about what I'm doing? What are my fears? How do I work with those? And all of those are products, if you like, of the unconscious. And as we start to bring these two things together, recognizing that the unconscious has a sort of compensatory, a purpose of its own, a compensatory function, a teleological function, then we can start to become healthier and happier on a journey of life, not by resolving the past, but by allowing ourselves to retell the past in new ways.
Yeah, and that this is so great, right? Because there is depth to people, not just in terms of depth in terms of time and looking at childhood, but there's depth in terms of our unconscious mind is formed by a lot of things that have happened throughout our lives, but it's also formed by everything that's happening constantly.
Yes.
So I think coaches often hesitate to go deep into a client's past, but I don't think we need to go deep into a client's past, and that seems to be the Jungian perspective as well, because the past is always in the present. It's always showing up.
Yeah.
We don't need to dig into childhood in order to, the childhood and how it's affecting us, it's always showing up by how we are showing up in the present moment. So coaches don't actually need to go and explore a lot in the past. They can explore the present, and it has clear links to the past. And I think that helps a lot of coaches work with clients in a much deeper way without that necessarily becoming psychotherapy or a psychoanalysis.
Well, because we're in the moment. I mean, Renos Papadopoulos is a great Jungian analyst, a really great writer, wrote, as the past shapes the present, so too does the present shape the past. Hmm. And I think that's really important, because if we then imagine that, if we accept that the deep in that sense is both pervasive and live and also misleading. Mm-hmm. Then our task to develop, and our task as coaches, is to help people, in essence, retell the past or make sense of the past in ways that are useful for them moving forward. You know, put it bluntly, are you a victim or are you a survivor? Either of those two narratives can work off the same broad memory of the past, but one of them may serve you in one way and one will serve you in another.
Yeah, there's so many psychological models around ego states and parent and child, or, you know, victim, perpetrator. And I mean, they often have developed from the same ideas, you know, but so helpful. That retelling the story, I think I really want to underline that. I mean, I know a lot of coaches who really love narrative approaches to coaching. And I think there's a lot of meeting points here as well. As the present also shapes the past, and as we are retelling our story, that seems to be a core aspect of Jungian work, that we actually have the power to look at how we reinvent ourselves or how we tell our story. And there's something around myth and fable and story. Could you tell us a little bit more about how Jungians work with clients, helping them to retell that story?
Well, I don't know if I can I can generalize about Jungians, because most of the people I've met, most of the analysts I work with, work in very different ways, and there's a wonderful spectrum. But that in itself is quite exciting. I mean, they used to sort of say that Jung has a sort of mercurial approach to his client work.
Mercurial,
yes. Exactly. You know, there was no consistent method in Jung's work.
Right.
But what I think Jung used to do, and what I think is the essence of Jungian work, it certainly is for me, is a very client-centered approach. You take principles and the ideas of Jungian work and reframe them to suit the particular needs of the client. That said, I think there are some sort of ideas. I mean, one of the techniques that I always imagine is, if we think of life as almost a spiral, what I typically see with my clients is they will repeat the same patterns of life over and over again. They'll tend to make the same mistakes, have the same issues, and the remembered past is therefore a really interesting clue, a key, if you like, to resolving a problem. If you have a particular issue when you were 15 and you worked it through, it could well be that the same approach that you use will work at 40. Not exactly the same, you know, because you're not literally the same person. But those kind of ideas, that finding what Jung referred to as a lifeline, not a lifeline of events, but a lifeline of themes, of symbols, of feelings. If we're able to locate ourselves on that lifeline and draw on some of the inspiration we've seen in the past, we can resolve problems in new ways. So hence, going back to the past, the purpose of the past is not necessarily just as a repressed kind of dead memory, but also an intuition, an inspiration for how we might resolve problems today, right now. And that doesn't mean that we do literally what we wanted to do. So, for example, yesterday I was talking to a client about her aspirations, and what therefore we went back to talk about what she wanted to do as a kid when she was 15, 16. And, you know, she was talking about opening a bookshop. She'll know who she is from listening to this thing. But it's not literally opening a bookshop. The question that's important is, well, what was in that? What was the inspiration for you? What did it mean to you at the time? And taking some of those inspirations, those symbolic ideas, what would that mean now? How would you take those ideas now and derive inspiration from them? Because this was a memory you've had of the past, and so the memory is relevant now in the present. So let's uncode it. Let's figure out what those symbols could mean. So there's a real difference there between Jungian and Freudian thinking, because in the Freudian world, a symbol, in effect, is a thing that can be decoded. It's a repressed artifact that you can figure it out. So you get your Taschenbuch of symbols out, and you put it on the table, and you go, this is what this means. That's not a Jungian approach. We would suggest instead that everything has the potential to become symbolic, but the symbol will be intensely personal, as well as potentially collective and possibly cultural. And you have to work that through. You have to sort of dance that with a client and find ways to understand the meaning of the symbol in the moment, in the present, and the meaning being determined not by an unlocking of the past, but by an unlocking of the future.
Yeah. I have that quite frequently, actually, when I tune in with a client and they tell me something, and it could be small talk, but I don't think it ever is really small talk. I think there's so much in there. And sometimes I find myself thinking, well, this feels like a metaphor for something. It feels like there's something in this. But then sometimes it might just not be. And I heard you say something very interesting. You said, Freudians often say, well, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And for Jungians, a cigar is never just a cigar. So symbolism seems to take an important role in this approach. So does everything always mean something more than what presents itself?
I think I'm going to be really specific about my wording here. I think there is the potential for everything that you notice to mean something more than the thing itself. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? The potential means that if you want to work with it, you can. The idea that something can then mean something more than itself, it depends on what you notice. Some symbols you don't notice. Some things you'll notice and I won't notice. I would suggest that is because they're not meaningful to me. But they are potentially meaningful to you.
Or you haven't paid attention to it.
Yeah, but in that sense, if you haven't paid attention to it, is it because I've repressed it? That's actually possibly true. Or is it because it simply has no meaning? I just haven't noticed it because it my mind is not creating the need to notice this thing.
No. It's a subjective meaning, right? It's not an objective meaning. I can't just Absolutely. Say, oh, this means this because you pointed towards, I don't know, you mentioned this and that's a phallic symbol, or, you know, this represents your mother. It's more like opening a space where the client can pay attention to the symbolism of what they're bringing.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, just sort of get crazy for a second. I mean, I have here a pack of tarot cards, which speaks to my ancestry, but there we go. If you imagine tarot cards, I don't believe that you can see the future. I just don't think that makes sense. It doesn't make sense. I know there is a sort of esoteric mathematical argument that everything is predetermined, but I kind of just don't buy that. I think, you know, the universe is too random. We do have choice. I don't know if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I think what's interesting, though, is the mind sees things intuitively. It has a great deal of systemic reach. And it has a systemic reach that we might not be consciously aware of. So what does a tarot card allow you to do? It unlocks a meaning. It unlocks a perspective that your rational mind might not be comfortable with. Your rational mind might not have noticed, have paid attention to. And it allows the possibility that there are other intuitive ways of understanding the world than the one you've worked with. It's the same as dream work. So you take a symbol like this, and you're not reading the future, but what you are doing is reading perspectives, reading new intuitions of possibility, which may have a future-facing implication. So, you know, if there are certain things that the system is generating in a way that it looks like this is becoming a probability, then something here may allow you to go, I sense this, I feel it, I see it, I can start to work with it as an idea. So in listening to our dreams, using symbols, using tarot cards or any other crazy stuff that we want to think about, what we're doing is accessing an unconscious intuition, turning
around
it into
symbolism.
A conscious space. Mm-hmm. And in turning it into a conscious space, we are creating something that we can consciously work with.
Yeah, so this is not a process of here's a card and I'm interpreting it for you and I'm reading you your future. It's more like here's a symbol, because they're essentially symbols and images on these cards. What do you make of that? Tapping into intuition, making the unconscious conscious.
Absolutely.
Is that how you work with it in coaching?
Yeah, I mean, I don't work with tarot cards in coaching. To be fair, that would probably freak out too many of my clients. But I'd be up for it if people wanted to do it, but people don't tend to go there. But I do work with things like dreams, fantasies, parapraxies. You know, if someone brings an idea to me, and it could be a dream, it could simply be an association or a memory. Then the question, back to our bookstore thing, then the question becomes, why have you raised this? Why have you talked now about the bookshop that you used to be taken to by your father when you were 15? Mm-hmm. What does that really mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean now? Not what does it mean then? Because then you don't know. It's past memory. You can, however, start to project into your past self some of those inspirations and intuitions. And that has relevance and meaning now. Mm-hmm. So in starting to work with that, we can start to understand a little bit more about what we're trying to do. So one of the things I suggested to this client was go to your favorite bookshop now, you know, straight after this meeting, if you've got time, go to your favorite bookshop, just take it in. Think about what it means to you. Think about what is important in being in this space. And then we can wonder about how you can use that intuition in your current role to solve this problem. Because the intuition, I didn't introduce it. They brought it to me. So if they brought it, then it has some relevance. So what do we do with that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to move slightly. You mentioned your heritage, which is in connection to the tarot cards, but like what I always found fascinating is these Jung's idea of the collective unconscious. And I think you hinted on that in various different ways already in this conversation, that we don't just stand on our individual story. We don't just stand on what we've experienced when we were young with our primary caregivers or the traumas that we carry, the experiences that we've had. But for Jung, this went a lot deeper and further, so that we seem to be, as far as I understand it now, we're connected to generations past and possibly generations future. Peter Hawkins has made this point. We discussed it here in this podcast as well. The kind of idea of seven generations back and forth. If we connect ourselves to that, it's a very different way of experiencing ourselves. And it took me a while, and I'm still not quite there, I think, to wrap my head around this idea of the collective unconscious, that there's more that influences us than what we have experienced, but we're experiencing it through past generations. Could you talk a little bit more about this and how it finds its relevance in the coaching space?
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of very Cartesian view that underpins Freudian work, but also kind of most psychology these days, which is we are somehow special. It has its roots in its religious origins. You know, human beings are different to animals. We're special. We're God's created thing, and we, as an individual, I think, therefore I am, have the capacity to make sense of the world, and therefore our view, as we look down, if you like, from the ego, is a world view of making sense with certainty of something which is personal, which belongs to you. If you flip that a little bit, imagine it from the bottom up. Yeah, you have a perspective, rational one, that sits on top of a series of unexamined, unconscious impulses and intuitions, what we might think of as the person unconscious. Some of that came from your parents, true enough, but they got theirs from somewhere. So they got theirs from their parents. In addition, you have the groups that you're part of, the institutions you work for, the histories that exist for them. You have a culture. Your parents were embedded in a culture. You have a land, you have a people, you have a religious inheritance, you have a cultural inheritance. Below that, there is an inheritance, what we might think of as the collective, that because we are human, there are certain things that we have in our psyche. And below that, of course, is the simplicity in a way of the, and complexity of the psychoid, which is this connection between world and physical state. So, for example, one of the things about human beings is after birth, we can't live without care. You had care, otherwise you wouldn't be here. And therefore, the kind of need for care and nurturance is within us. It's an experience of body that defines our psychology. So therefore we get the collective, which builds up, and you get these kind of maternal archetypes and mother goddess figures and all of that other good stuff, which then becomes cultural, and different cultures interpret care and parenting in different ways. And then your parents would have personally experienced that in a different way. And then you would have experienced that in a different way. And then on top of that, you have all of the education and things that move through life that decide how you want to be a father. So all of these things are in the system. And only a small amount of it you're aware of. And perhaps, you know, for the overly rational people, there is a belief that, well, it's all from me. And I just think that's kind of narcissistic and slightly odd. The really interesting question then becomes, well, where am I from? So when we start to work with coaching, what are the real implications of that? Sometimes the things that drive people are not from their parents. Sometimes it comes from their culture. Sometimes it comes from the organizational structures they find themselves part in. And some of it's just being human. I mean, the midlife experience, the adolescent experience, these are kind of fundamental shifts that we all experience, regardless of our cultures. So how do we then work with that? So what we're doing in a way as a coach, I think, from a Jungian stance, is looking at things from a much more systemic perspective, and starting to understand how you are within system rather than seeing the system as being outside you.
Right. So this is the systemic perspective on this. I can totally get that we are influenced by how our other generations have been influenced. Some of it is cultural. Sometimes I get this idea, and I want to check that with you, that there's a collective unconscious, more in the sense of a collective consciousness that people tap into, so that we can be influenced, like that there's something there that we all share. There's something that we all seem to somehow tap into. The complexities of intricate nested systems, I totally get that, but I wonder if there's something there that we can tap into that is available for everybody, some form of energy. And I know you've been talking about energy, or is this the systemic net of complex interactions?
But this is where we come back to the depth again. These things are always present. I mean, even Freud was very clear that the unconscious is timeless. Mm-hmm. It exists now in the moment. And all of these experiences are current, if that makes sense. Not exactly as they were with your ancestors, but the ancestral sort of dimension is there with you right now. Now, if we start to think about that, and we imagine the collective, we imagine the cultural unconscious, the existence of the cultures that we are in as lived experiences, maybe the groups we're part of, what we can start to see is that these systems aren't outside us. They're actually within us. They are the substrate upon which our conscious mind rests. So it seems a bit kind of esoteric, but the difference is that instead of seeing ourselves as somehow special and different, and these things as almost other, as a threat to us, as an outside beyond us, the cultures we're part of as being somehow different, and we should be able to separate ourselves from them. It's the a different way of thinking about it is, much of what I am is because of this thing. You know, if we imagine in you're going to psychoanalysis and you do your X number of years, it took me, I don't know, 4 years to realize that actually my parents were not really much to do with my psyche. They had their thing, obviously, but it was much more than that. It was much more a cultural issue that went back generations. And in understanding that, it allowed me to make sense of my personality much more than simply looking at my family background.
So that kind of implies that there is a lot of work that we would need to do to kind of explore the past, explore our ancestry, explore generations back, right? For a lot of people, it's difficult to trace more than one or two generations back. But that there seems to be some kind of historical ancestry work that would be quite helpful for this kind of approach.
I think so. And this is what Jung was a past master of. I mean, you know, the whole collective unconscious idea, I mean, it admittedly arose from a dream, but he founded a lot of his work on that by looking back at, you know, the symbols and imagery of different cultures over different times, different time periods. I mean, he's very focused on Greek archaeology and Greek religion and philosophy, partly because that was popular, I think, in Europe at that time. But once we start to look back, we don't necessarily need to know our particular ancestral tree, but the myths that are spoken in our family. Mm. And not just our families, actually, our organizations in some cases. I mean, you know, so one of my clients is a 600-year-old bank, and they have a culture. They have myths. They have stories. They have a family home that people go and visit if they're one of the sort of anointed ones. So all of these sorts of things really matter, because they shed your own psyche is floating within this series of influences and impulses.
So how much agency do we have in then shaping this? Because on the one hand, it seems that we can retell our story. On the other hand, it seems that there are things in our past and in our culture and in our ancestry that influence us.
Yeah. Jung said, and I love this quote, I use it a lot, that identity is an unconscious conformity. And I really like this as an idea. What he was really talking about is that the identity we assume is made up of unexamined and unexplored conformities with ideas. Mm. So we might take a national identity. I might look at Englishness, which is something I don't particularly identify with. But anyway, let's just pretend I do for the sake of the book. I might then assume that this means a certain number of things because that's what the people around me have. Because I, you know, I see the royal family and I see Westminster and I see all of the other kind of nonsense that we participate in, and I see what happened, you know, the village fates, and my parents have a view on it. My father, my stepfather was a vicar. So all of this kind of stuff plays out. But I don't think about what it means. I just assume that is what it is. If we want to develop, if we want choice, then we must start to examine some of the things that have made us. Now, some of that is parental and family. Absolutely true. But I think it is really important to go, well, where am I from? Where's my land? How do I identify myself? So if I call myself English, what does that mean? And as a coaching conversation, I often think it's really interesting to say that. You know, if you say you're a banker, okay, so what's a banker?
Is it?
Exactly who you do. What is English? What is male? What is female? What is black? What is white? You know, what is whatever identities you choose to frame around you? And then start to break that down a little bit and move it from being an unconscious conformity to a conscious choice. Yeah. And then you can start taking control of what narrative you want to spin, how you want to live your life.
Yeah, I love that. So at what point do you think that then becomes analysis or therapy, or does it even matter to you?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I mean, some years ago, I wrote about this in my book. I was, remember sitting with a very experienced psychoanalyst, Jungian, in the Jung Institute, and we were looking out over Lake Zurich. And I said to him, "So, what's the difference between psychotherapy and coaching?" And he sucked his teeth and looked out over the waters and very wisely turned to me and said, "Actually, it's quite an easy question. About £450 an hour." I quite like that, because he was only partly joking, in the sense that we are working intersubjectively in relationship to help a client retell their narrative in a way that requires them to rethink the identifications, this issue I was just mentioning, that they cling to, in an attempt to make the conscious to make the unconscious conscious. Now, if we're both doing that, what is the difference between coaching and psychotherapy? And I do think there is a difference, and I think the difference is in two things. One, the difference lies in the modality. I work with clients sometimes who have no means of consciously expressing what is in the unconscious. Let's just say someone has suffered an extreme trauma that they are unable to begin to integrate. So they are repressing that. There are no words. That sort of work requires, in my view, long extended periods of time, possibly years, possibly decades in some cases, to approach the thing that needs to be integrated, the experience that they have to make sense of. That is psychotherapy. If nothing else, on a cost basis, that is psychotherapy. Because it's going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of non-directive and psychologically, how do we even begin to describe this? It's going to take a lot of non-directive work to begin to circle and approach the problem. I think that's psychotherapy.
Yeah, the other end, best done weekly and best done regularly,
in whatever format is needed. Yeah, but it's. I think the important thing is the duration. It takes time. Mm-hmm. There are other clients that I work with who, they've had some, you know, there's some difficult experiences that get raised. I mean, some pretty traumatic stuff. Quite often those clients are able to talk about it, and they're able to talk about it in the context of their current lives. Now, potentially psychotherapy could be useful in that context, but for some of those clients, that's not what they need. I mean, some of my supervision clients are psychotherapists, and they're not taking it to psychotherapy, they're taking it to me. On occasion, there is a different, sharper, perhaps quicker, shorter term approach to deal with things. Mm-hmm. which leads us more towards the coaching. So I think that's spectrum one, which is the client. Second spectrum is then the practitioner. What are we trained to do? I think if we think again about that, there are many psychotherapists work with the same people as I do, with the same problems, but for much less money. There are a number of psychotherapists who are working with very different clients, perhaps experiencing profound trauma over prolonged periods of time in very particular contexts, and they are trained differently to me. I couldn't do their work because I'm not trained to do their work. And in some cases, my own psychology would make it very difficult for me. It would be very confronting to do their work. There are other clients that I'm very comfortable dealing with because I'm trained well. I've been through ranges of things. I have good supervision. I have been through analysis, all of this sort of good stuff. And I feel more comfortable dealing with it. So I think in a way there is what I would describe as a therapeutic zone. And we probably don't do ourselves or our clients any favors by drawing a straight line. I mean, if we come back to the definition, psychotherapy is CBT and CBC are broadly interchangeable. And yet CBT and Jungian analysis are complete different things. They don't fit in the same bracket. And I think it's same with true with coaching. You know, if I'm doing performance coaching for athletes, I'm not going to work with midlife people, you know, midlife transitions and senior executives. I'm not going to work with the various angst and doubt that that brings because I'm not trained to do it. I may think I'm trained to do it, but I'm not trained to do it. And so we need a little more granularity, I think, in the way we think about coaching and the way we think about actually, psychotherapy is pretty good at this when you talk to them, in, you know, as a community. Coaches are pretty bad at this. We think of coaching as being a homogenous block that is all the same, and it really isn't the same.
It really isn't. Yeah. There's a lot of responsibility working with that kind of depth. And I think one of the key differences I keep picking up, and I think that's quite helpful, is how resourced is this client or how vulnerable is this client feeling at this time?
Yeah.
And I think the more vulnerable the client feels, the more risky it is it to work with it as a coach. But we can do deep work with someone who feels relatively whole, maybe not whole, you know, but like who feels like they can constructively think about it and access it without, you know, breaking down or, you know, disintegrating or just in free fall for weeks on time. Or
yeah, but there's also the coaches themselves, is we don't think about that enough. I mean, yeah, the client's vulnerability is important, but also the vulnerability of the coach. What do we project into our clients? So if we come back to, you know, Wilfred Bion's idea of containment, one of the core aspects of containment was what he termed detoxification. So or what is termed detoxification. If a client confesses something to us and we look at them with horror and say, you need to go and talk to a therapist, we've been unable to detoxify that emotion. So what we've actually done is returned it to them in an amplified form, potentially. Mm. We've made it worse. We've actually damaged the client, created harm as a result of our own fear, because what they've brought to us makes us afraid. Mm-hmm. So some of this, you know, dependent on sort of ideas like depth and trauma and all of that good stuff, depends a bit on the projected fantasies of the coach, which is why I think coach training matters a great deal. If a coach is going to do work with midlife transitions, I really think they need to have been in psychotherapy for an extended period of time. I think they need to be trained in psychodynamic work, and I think they need good supervision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm really blunt, I think the difference in this sense between coaches and psychotherapists are there are less bad psychotherapists because their training is better. And I think the problem with coach training, because of this generic kind of homogenous interpretation of coaching, is that everyone thinks they can do everything. And that's not true at all.
Yeah, and psychotherapy training requires placement and their own therapy and supervision. Yes. And it's also much, much, much longer, you know, which makes it less accessible. But like they do invest a lot more time and resources and journey into themselves a lot more. Many coaches have done the same thing, right? Don't get me wrong.
Absolutely.
Many coaches are, but most coach training is doesn't have that kind of breadth and doesn't have that kind of length.
There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. If the work you're doing is superficial work.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if what you're going to do is help people polish their performance a bit, I think that's fine.
Absolutely.
But if you're going to work with topics that are potentially below the surface, that do evoke anxiety, you know, rage, shame, all of that sort of good stuff, then you have to have been there personally.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, there's so many topics we could still talk about with relatively little time. I know we had kind of a back and forth and I kind of know your perspective on this, but I feel obliged to bring types up again. Just because so many coaches, love working with MBTI and Insight and, you know, the colors and Enneagram and all of these personality kind of assessments, they seem to be based on Jung's archetypes. And so I wanted to talk a little bit. I know your perspective on this is critical, but I think it's really helpful. So without dampening people's enthusiasm around working with personality type assessment, I think it opens up really helpful conversations.
Yeah.
But it depends how we work with that. So could you tell us a little bit about Jung's type work, why you're critical about it, particularly in the context of coaching?
Well, I'm not critical about it. For one thing, it's not something I use. I think as well, it's important to stress there's the difference between types and archetypes. Mm-hmm. Archetypes, there are a whole bunch of crimes committed in the names of archetypes. I've seen people say there are 12 archetypes or whatever. There is a limitless number of archetypes. And archetypes cannot be represented as an archetype.
What do you
the
mean?
Representation. Well, there is no archetype for the Great Mother. There is no archetype for the warrior. It don't exist. There is an archetype which we can best represent in particular cultural forms by the warrior or the great mother.
Mm. So people can identify with it, but it's actually fluid.
Yeah, it's not archetypal. It's not an archetype. It may be archetypal. It may carry the energy of the archetype. It may be a best guess. So we can talk about the great mother as an archetype, knowing that we're not really talking about the archetype. We're talking about a collection of ideas which exist for us in the collective, cultural, personal context. So archetypes are themselves can be really useful, but what I often see within coaching is this idea that there is an archetype and it is a thing, and we can talk about it in concrete terms, and it's one of a limited, finite number. All of those are misreadings of Jungian work.
It strikes me that there's in the context of what we've been talking about, right? It strikes me that there's a symbolism in an archetype and that people often use these archetypes to take them on as an identity so that they start telling their story around this archetype.
Yeah. And that becomes a bit of a problem because in practical terms, we then force the story into a preset idea that is defined in essence by culture rather than let's explore other possibilities here. And the archetype can open up ideas. I mean, archetypal ideas are fantastic because they bring energy, they bring direction, they bring a sharing. But the danger we run is when we move beyond this idea that we're using symbol to explore something that is a shared human trait versus this is a thing and it is distinct and different.
Yeah.
And this gross oversimplification. And I don't think it's very helpful, actually. Then you have psychological types. Now, psychological types, I'm not an expert in this by any means, so any Jungians listening to this will probably go, he's completely wrong. obviously I've read about psychological types. I've read the things that I need to read, but my understanding is that they are preferred structures within ego consciousness that allow us to face the world. Mm-hmm. And Jung's kind of fundamental idea is not that we were this or we were that, and that was a good thing to be one or the other, but that the integration of the two, coming back to this idea of integration, is the ultimate goal of our individuation. So if you are, for instance, an extrovert, according to Jungian thinking or Jung's thinking, the risk you run is that you identify with the outside world and your inner theatre dies. You lose a sense of who you are. If you are an introvert, you have a sense of who you are, but that becomes indulgent and separate and different from the outside world. So your relationships are damaged. Jung's perspective is that somehow these two need to be brought together. We need to exist in the context of the world in which we live. We need to make choices knowing that others are impacted by those choices. And so the fundamental theory of psychological types, if we work on the basis that a psychological type brings a blessing and a curse, and our role is in a way to find balance, I think they can be really helpful. I just don't use them. It's not my practice.
Yeah, and this is really helpful to kind of have a more balanced view on this, because I remember I did an MBTI assessment, and I did it in person with a practitioner, there's like 15-minute tests on the internet, and I think that's really not helpful. But I sat there for like about 2 hours with this person, and I remember on the introversion extroversion scale, I couldn't quite decide. It took like 5 levels deep until I figured out whether I'm an introvert or an extrovert. And yeah. I learned through that process that I do generally recharge my batteries when I'm on my own, right? But I get also so much energy from connecting with people and just speaking my mind and letting things out. So, and that's still very much alive in me, depending on what the context is. So yeah. I took introversion as a piece of my identity. I often say I'm an introvert, and then some people laugh at me. Yeah, because they don't experience me like that. And sometimes I don't experience myself as that. But I think it's a good illustration of like that psychological types can really kind of box us in, or with best intentions, we can kind of invite our clients to box themselves in when we're just so much more than that.
Yeah. And this is fundamental for Jungian work. You know, it's not an either or. We have a duality within us, because that is in a way part of the human state, and it's part of how we fit in. It's part of how we learn to be basically adult. But to develop, to individuate, requires this understanding of what is happening in the unconscious and a bringing that into the conscious mind in a way that allows us to make choices. And of course, then we're naturally faced with the idea that every identity we have has a dark side, a shadow side, an aspect that is not helpful to us. Yeah. So if we view types, psychological types, as a landscape around which we can have discussion about personality and development and how we might mitigate our sort of dualistic excesses, I think it's a great tool. If it becomes, I'm an extrovert and that is me, I think it's very dangerous, and it's also not very Jungian.
Yeah. You mentioned shadow there, and that was on my list, but also I think we're nearly out of time. If I gave you a few minutes to talk about shadow in the context of coaching and why it might be important to study it a little bit more depth, what would you say?
This is a difficult one. Shadow work, or working with the shadow, I don't like the idea of shadow work. Shadow working with the shadow is foundational to Jungian work, because the shadow forms as a response to the persona. So the persona is our social self. We learn these tricks and tips to get on in the world. If we want to make more conscious choices about our persona, recognizing that the limitations of society, the unconscious conformities, we can overcome them. At some point, we're going to have to face shadow. And shadow is the thing that we cannot be. At the center of it lies this sort of archetypal terror of darkness and death and destruction and murder and genocide and all the really, really appalling things that humanity does. But for most of us, that's not our reality. It is, however, the shadow of the shadow, the kind of threat that we see in the corner of our eyes is always this thing about, if I do this thing, I'm going to be a really bad person. If I speak out in this meeting, I'm going to be a really bad person. If I don't speak, I'm going to be really weak and really bad. So at some point, we'll have to confront the shadow and to start to wonder about, are these despised and repressed aspects of my personality useful in some ways? Can I work with them? Can I forgive myself? Can I have compassion for myself in this context? So shadow work's an inevitability. What worries me a little bit, though, about shadow again, and I think this is where Jungian psychology is, you know, its popularization has become a bit problematic, is people sort of almost have this sort of performative frisson from working with shadow. The reality of shadow work with people, or reality of working with people's shadows, shall I say, is that it's dark and uncomfortable and frightening, and you encounter shame and you encounter guilt and you encounter rage and you encounter all sorts of emotions that they find it hard to bear and you find it hard to bear. It's not a kind of holiday destination. And if we are going to work at depth, at some point we will encounter the shadow. And if we are going to work with the shadow, we need to have faced our own shadow, which comes back to the need for coach training. Because otherwise, when we really face with the shadow, the first thing we're going to do is run. And that's damaging for the client. Mm-hmm. There was a workshop I ran some years ago, which was quite funny. We were I was talking about shadow, and I thought, I want to give people something that's actually a really good representation of the personal shadow, that actually expresses some of these really uncomfortable emotions. And quite often when we talk about shadow, we talk about the horrible stuff that we see in humanity, sort of genocides and things, which are often at distance, not for the unlucky few, but for many of us they're at existence. It's a kind of shadow Disney world. I hate to use that term.
Shadow Disney world.
Yeah, well, it feels frightening, but it's frightening at a distance. Mm-hmm. It's not of us.
Are you scared of Disney world?
That's true. So what I did instead was I played a Frankie Boyle video of a joke that had a strong implications of child abuse. And the thing with the joke is, one, it's very funny, and two, it's very dark. And everybody in the room watched this thing and then looked at me as if I'd done a really bad thing in playing this video. And I said to them, you know, we're talking about the shadow. How do you feel at the moment? And you get these kind of, I shouldn't watch that. That was really bad. It was really distasteful. It's really unpleasant. Okay. So what did you expect the shadow to feel like? And if you're not, as a coach, prepared to work with emotions that are genuinely difficult, mm-hmm. profoundly unpleasant to work with, because you've worked with them yourself, mm-hmm. if you haven't done that, I wouldn't do shadow work, and I certainly would be very cautious about anything pertaining to the unconscious, because at some point you have to go there.
Yeah,
that makes sense. But
yeah, that makes sense. It took me back to a moment I had in a meeting, get together, community event sort of thing, and the facilitator was talking about shadow in a way, and I remember I showed up, and it seemed like that he wanted to bring this out, and I was there, and I. In that period of time, I felt pretty good about myself, pretty confident, you know. I was pretty lucky in that I don't have like huge repressed childhood traumas that show up and make my life very complicated. And everybody's got their traumas, and everybody's got their experience that influenced them. I've explored myself to quite a degree, and there's things that that shame was the thing, right? He was talking about shame. Yeah. And it felt like to me that I should be ashamed just generally, and I mean there's things that I'm not proud of, there's, you know, there's shadow, there's darkness, there's stuff that I know I'm carrying, and but it's not that I'm ashamed of that necessarily. Mm. You know. Yeah. So I remember sitting there and thought to myself, in some ways this often, I think this sometimes happens in therapy or in analysis, that people feel like they should feel bad about themselves. When yeah. actually facing shadow means something different. It's not necessarily that you need to be ashamed of things that you're feeling or crazy thoughts that you have. I mean, if we just portray our thoughts to the outside, everybody would think we're insane. I've had some pretty dark thoughts, but they're moments, yeah. right? So,
and this is about the training of the coach, because I think if we go digging, if we've just learned about the shadow and we're desperately excited and we think everybody should talk about it, we are going to create some profoundly unethical moments. And there are people who, you know, we're not going to be able to set up a space well enough to carry what we evoke. Individuals may or may not choose to share. In group context, this is really dangerous, oh, yeah. I think. And that's why I'm always nervous about this idea of shadow work. And I think it's more interesting to imagine our familiarity with the shadow as an idea, so that when people choose to bring it, they choose to bring it. And we are prepared for that choice. We can hold them through the choices they've made. But I think if we kind of force people to disclose, we take away agency and we risk harm. And I think both of those two things are rather problematic. And for me, a central piece actually of my work is I'll talk about what my clients bring. And I'll ask difficult questions about what they bring. But it's not for me to assume that they want to talk about.
Yeah, it's not for you to draw it out, but you work with what they are drawing out of themselves.
Exactly the point.
And you can explore further and probe further, but it's
not
you guiding that process.
I'm just projecting onto them. Right. And I, you know, that's, I think that's profoundly unethical, actually.
Yeah. Well, on that happy note, I think we're out of time. I wonder if you might want to end on a different note. Is there something that you would invite or encourage coaches out there to do or to think about or to reflect on?
I'm quite happy ending on shadow because I do quite like the darkness. But I'll come back to stories a little bit, to narrative. I think our work as coaches, whether Jungian or not, but our work as coaches is to help people retell the stories. You know, human beings are storytelling animals. This is something we really do, and we've done it, you know, through recorded history. Every culture has its stories. We tell stories. They help us make meaning of the world. And our role as coaches, in a way, is to help tell stories. And I think the reason Jungian work is so useful is it's the narrative, if you like, of the Jungian world is symbolic, mythic. It lends itself really well to stories. And crucially, it lends itself to the idea that stories are just going to keep being told. There is no final happy ending. You know, you marry the prince or the princess and you live happily ever after, and then it all begins again. And as if we kind of see the mind in that way, as an ability to be constantly learning to tell stories, to create the narratives we need to help us forward, that I think is the essence of coaching work.
I love that.
It's not the stories we tell, it's the telling of the stories.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Lawrence, I want to thank you so much for your time and for your ability to draw out complex ideas in a really engaging way. I appreciate your time, appreciate your work. If somebody wanted to get closer to your sphere, learn more from you in some way, where would they find you? Where would they go?
Oh, LinkedIn. Just drop me a line on LinkedIn or follow me on LinkedIn and join, you know, because I make comments on that sporadically whenever I can be moved to do that. So yeah, that's definitely the best way to contact me.
Brilliant. Well, with that, thank you very much and go well.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.